第三十一单元教育改革
Unit 31 Reform in Education
篇章交传
Passage for consecutive interpretation Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese
I want to talk a little bit today about the revolution in American education We must leave no child behindWe are not satisfied with a society that graduates citizens who cannot read, write, or do basic math, nor are we satisfied to turn out young men and women unprepared to enter fine institutions of higher learning such as this, unprepared to compete in the global economy, unprepared, really, for life itself. Our revolution in education will take an evolution in awareness and thought.We can do it, but all of us, teachers, principals, parents, colleges, business and community leaders, must work together and agree to accept nothing less than the best for our kids. I fervently believe that every child can learn, but first, every child must see that potential in him or herself, and so must every teacher, administrator, and of course, parent.No child left behind recognizes the inborn potential in every child. It seeks to level the playing field for everyone, regardless of skin color, spoken accent, or street address. Under the law, states must show how their students will reach proficiency, grade level or better, in reading, writing, and mathematics. In exchange, they're granted unprecedented flexibility to get the job done.I am proud to say that it's been 1 year since all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, submitted their accountability plans and had them approved. Now those plans are in action. Under the law, adequate yearly progress must be measured and maintained for all students, and, here's the key, all categories and subgroups of students as well. We cannot leave teachers behind either.Our goal is for all teachers of core academic subjects to be highly qualified. That means a bachelor's degree, certification by the state, and demonstration of subject matter competency for each subject taught. We're augmenting that with a teacher-to-teacher initiative with roundtables, workshops, and the first-ever research-to-practice summit. Under NCLB, schools in need of improvement,must spend at least 10% of their Title I funds to assist teachers through professional development or college coursework. Districts can also use Title II Improving Teacher Quality State Grants to fill in the gaps through alternative certification, merit pay, or recruiting incentives. We've launched two new programs, Reading First and Early Reading First.That are instructing tens of thousands of teachers in scientifically sound, proven teaching methods. No more fads. Our goals are ambitious. All teachers highly qualified and all children proficient. But are they unrealistic? I don't believe so. This is a nation that went from the Wright brothers to Neil Armstrong in less than one lifetime.Seeing our children reach grade level in 10 years is not asking too much. No Child Left Behind, I would add, is not a punitive law, as some in the media have described it. The remedies for schools that do not meet their goals is not punishment, but help. Help for both schools and the parents. Tutoring, after-school and summer school programs, and transfer to another public school are options that must be provided.If the school continues to lag behind. The need is there. In its first year, more than 160,000 students took advantage of these choices. This illustrates another revolutionary aspect of the law. There is no shortage of people willing to help. Community groups, business leaders, profit providers, community colleges, and four-year universities all must be allowed to be part of the solution.No Child Left Behind is spawning more choices for more students. Businesses are joining with educators to form charter schools, Some states are starting charter colleges to train teachers in hard-to-fill subjects. Ladies and gentlemen, we know what works, and we know that public education is working for many, many young Americans. Knowing that, it would be unconscionable to deny what works to so many others. We face an achievement gap, but it's one we can bridge with a little more achievement of our own. It's time to bring everyone to the same table, those who shape society and those who are shaped by society, to find common cause on these critical issues. We owe it not only to the generations coming after us, but to those who came before us, like Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, and Linda Brown, the men and women who refused to buckle under to racists, who blazed a path of freedom for all of us, and who insisted that the American dream is not limited by color or creed. A revolutionary idea indeed. The American dream is about ensuring that our children have greater opportunities than we had. It's wonderful to know that it's within our power to make that dream come true. I thank you for doing more than your share to make it happen.
第32单元，环境安全。
Unit 32, Environmental Security.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to participate in this symposium on environmental security. We cannot narrow our vision to only railroads, bridges, and factories. Nor can we narrow our endeavors merely to imitation. We must make economic prosperity foster intellectual and spiritual contributions which keep our civilizations alive and contribute to the onward march of human civilization. A great man once said, "I do not want my house to be walled in on all sides and my windows to be stuffed. I want the culture of all the lands to be blown about my house as freely as possible. But I refuse to be blown off my feet by any." That man was Mahatma Gandhi. I believe we would do well to remember his words today. The great economic and social issues of our time are intimately linked with the quest for political stability. But during the past few years, people have been increasingly concerned with the impact of the current ecological crises on the political stability of nations and regions, and even within societies. Today, people around the world, particularly in the developing world, are struggling to survive in the face of growing deserts, dwindling forests, declining fisheries, poisoned food, water, air, and climatic extremes and weather events that continue to intensify, floods, droughts, and hurricanes. The question that must be asked is whether the scarcity of renewable resources such as cropland, forest, freshwater, and fisheries, could precipitate violent civil or international conflicts. There are clear signs that environmental scarcities could contribute to violent conflicts in many parts of the world. In the coming decades, accelerating environmental pressures could transform the very foundations of the international political system. Let us take the availability of water first. Supplies of fresh water are finite. As the demand grows and in the absence of clear consensus on how best to use shared water resources for the benefit of all, that competition has the potential of erupting into acrimonious disputes. An even greater threat to future human welfare is through the undermining of the productivity of the land through accelerated soil erosion, increased flooding, and declining soil fertility. The growing number of people affected by desertification, estimated to be 1 billion, are not simply waiting to be touched by the magic wand of development. They are literally losing ground as their lands suffer more and more from the effects of this disease. The continuous decline of global biological diversity and the traditional habitats of indigenous and traditional people also has an impact on intensifying conflicts between and within societies. Most of the areas of mega biodiversity are inhabited by indigenous and traditional people. They provide an inextricable link between cultural and biological diversity. Today, we are in the process of profoundly remaking international trade and markets. Globalization and international trade have become almost an ideology, promising a radiant future for us all. But is there a dark side? Have we looked at other impacts? For example, is globalization destroying subsistence agriculture? Are we co-opting third world farmers into production for the international marketplace while their societies are made dependent on imported food? Cultural diversity is more than skin color or physical characteristics. It is more than language, song, and dance. It is the embodiment of values, institutions, and patterns of behavior. It is a composite whole representing a people's historical experience, aspirations, and worldview. Deprive a people of their language, culture, and spiritual values, and you deprive them of their sense of direction and purpose. Political conflicts occur when political and economic institutions and processes wrest control over traditionally held resources without negotiations or compensation. Conflicts could occur when political and economic institutions and processes degrade environmental settings and place individuals and populations at risk. Political conflicts occur because people find themselves forcibly relocated while governments and industry expand export-oriented industries, develop international tourist facilities. The global community must improve its ability to identify emerging environmental problems and assess alternative responses. Formulating effective global, regional, and national policies on matters vital to our future requires the ability, the foresight, capability to make accurate, long-term projections of global trends and their interactions in areas such as population, natural resources, environmental quality, and other factors of geopolitical significance. It also requires structure to link the results of such projections directly to current decision-making. Foresight is not prediction. It is not central planning, and it is not a surrender to computer models. Rather, it is a process for bringing better information into the decision-making process, for linking analysis and decision, and for obtaining the best available description of the potential implications of policy choices. Foresight is the capability to effectively assess and monitor the long-term changes in the environment. It will also give the ability to identify environmental hotspots with the potential of breaking into violent conflicts. Environmental securities can also be improved by reducing the distance between the decision makers and the people who are supposed to benefit from their decisions. The challenge before the global community is to design enabling mechanisms to increase people's participation in development. And it has to maintain an effective two-way communities and to ensure that the benefits of sustainable development reach the marginalized, the political, invisible masses. Thank you for your attention.
第33单元, 医学常识.
Unit 33, General Knowledge of Medicine.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
It has been found that a large number of human diseases have a genetic basis. This knowledge lends importance to the development of eugenics. 3% of humans have hereditary diseases which are transmitted in a Mendelian fashion. 5% more have familial traits which indicate a genetic basis but cannot be analyzed as Mendelian traits, and these numbers are increasing. Two diseases which account for the deaths of hundreds of thousands a year, cancer and heart disease, are thought to have some genetic component. Scientists working in the field of immunogenetics are trying to discover the nature of resistance to cancer, which also has a heritable component. In the future, they will try to stimulate or create the same condition in all individuals. A recent study has shown that some forms of heart disease may be inherited as an autosomal dominant trait. An understanding of the genetic basis would alert persons from families with an incidence of the disease to the possibility of incurring heart conditions and perhaps cause them to alter their diets and life habits accordingly. For example, those who may inherit genes for heart trouble would stop smoking and avoid high-fat diets. The rise in numbers of mutagens and carcinogens in our environment has led geneticists to believe that these agents will continue to increase. Unless routine screening for mutagenic effects is developed, science will be unable to devise euphonic measures for each new disease condition. But use of euphonic measures may mean countering the forces of natural selection, which are the basis for the evolutionary strength of a species. PKU homozygotes normally do not reproduce and transmit the harmful mutations to future generations. When they do develop normally, and every member of the next generation would be a carrier of the mutation, assuming that the spouse is normal. This will add to our genetic load and weaken the human species from the evolutionary point of view. Should we then, as some believe, counsel such individuals against reproduction, or even legally prohibit them from having children for the good of the species? If we decide on this course for homozygotes of PKU, should we not extend the same philosophy to those whose families have a history of heart trouble or schizophrenia? Such questions lead us to the area of eugenics.
第34单元，地球灾难。
Unit 34, Global Disaster.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
What caused Earth's biggest extinction? The answer may lie in tiny buckyballs filled with extraterrestrial gas.It occurred in a blink of an eye, geologically speaking, about 250 million years ago. In the space of a few thousand years, something terrible happened to our planet, something that wiped out 90% of Earth's ocean species and about 70% of those that lived on land. It was the worst extinction in the history of the Earth. Scientists called it the Great Dying. It eliminated whole communities of coral reefs,forests of fern-like trees, giant amphibians and ferocious reptiles, swarms of seemingly indestructible insects, and the ocean's ubiquitous trilobites, those hard-shelled invertebrates with complex eyes that were never seen on the planet again. What caused the so-called Permian extinction? Any number of scenarios have been offered, ranging from the explosion of a nearby starto ice age cooling and greenhouse warming. None of them were entirely convincing. Last week, a team led by a junior professor from the University of Washington appeared to have finally cracked the puzzle. Writing in the journal Science, the professor and her colleagues blame this mother of all extinctions, as she calls it, on the impact of an asteroid or comet like the one that probably wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. In each case, the damage would have been done not by the explosive collision itself, but by the series of global disasters it triggered. Furious volcanic eruptions, a rapid heating of the atmosphere, and the depletion of life-giving oxygen from the ocean. On what evidence do this professor and her colleagues base their conclusion?Tiny smoking guns in the form of soccer ball-shaped carbon molecules called Buckminster Fullerenes, or Buckyballs, after Buckminster Fuller, inventor of the geodesic dome. In sites ranging from Hungary to China and Japan, scientists digging in layers of 250 million-year-old rock found scattered Buckyballs that had trapped in their cage-like structure traces of extraterrestrial gas.Helium, and argon in a rare form that scientists know could have been forged only during star formation. The scientists can't say exactly where the comet or asteroid struck because the tectonic processes that rearrange the Earth's surface have since churned up most of the evidence. But they can estimate its size. It probably measured 4 to 7 miles across, roughly half the size of the island of Manhattan, and it would have slammed into the Earth with the force of a magnitude 12 earthquake.
第35单元 再生能源
Unit 35 The Renewable Energy
篇章交传
Passage for Consecutive Interpretation Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, we all know that energy is fundamental to us, to the stability and growth of our economies, the cohesion of our societies, and the very quality of our daily lives. Yet, for too long, here in the UK and across the developed world, we have taken access to energy resources for granted. It's so easy for us to turn on the lights and heating that we give barely a thought to it. And yet we are far too dependent on existing energy resources, which are neither finite nor secure. Demand for energy is outstripping supply capacity, and science teaches us more than ever of the damage we are causing to the globe by unchecked consumption of high carbon products. So too, the developing world faces its own energy problems. Here too, dependency on unsecured energy imports and an imbalance between supply and demand imposes often devastating economic pressures. The absence of a sustained energy supply in many parts of Africa, Latin America, and Asia imposes constraints on economic growth and development, creating a self-perpetuating cycle of poverty and underdevelopment. In the energy field, then, there is a unique synergy of national interests across all our continents. If we are to ensure safe access to the plentiful energy resources we need in the future, we must all face up urgently to the global challenges that face us in this policy sphere: security, dependence, poverty, and climate change. In short, we need to change the way that we both produce and consume our energy. We need not just access to secure energy resources, but access to clean energy supplies, environmentally sound energy supplies, and affordable energy supplies. The partnership REEEP that we celebrate here today enshrines many of the progressive principles that underpin the work and outlook of the UK government: a commitment to international cooperation and engagement, increased support for the nations of the developing world, the pursuit of sustainable development, and a progressive global environmental agenda. This partnership also signifies our commitment to renewable energy as a means to bring about the changes necessary to improve energy security, to foster economic development and greater social equality, whilst at the same time reducing the environmental impact of energy consumption and production. Firstly, renewable energy will enhance the security of many nations by reducing dependence on imported fossil fuels. The energy supplies of too many countries are vulnerable to disruption, with all the attendant problems of economic and social dislocation that energy shocks and crises bring with them. Secondly, a commitment to renewables will also help us address the pressing environmental challenges facing us all. They will help us tackle the health problems resulting from pollution and the destruction of our ecosystems. And by replacing traditional energy sources with cleaner energy supplies, we can help to slow down and ameliorate the damage done through global warming and climate change. Thirdly, the economic development of those nations that have hitherto been held back by a lack of access to sustainable energy supplies will also be encouraged by a move towards renewables. Through access to energy in this newer form, nations will be able to support greater growth and output, industrial innovation and development, and these new energy sources and technologies will themselves create valuable new commercial opportunities for us all. We are already beginning to see some of the fruits of our partnership working across the globe, delivering those sustainable programs. A UK company, Bronze Oak, is working with our EEEP partners in the Philippines to use the byproducts of that country's sugar industry to bolster the foundations of the power sector through renewable cogeneration. We are working with Chinese partners to explore the potential for tradable renewable energy certificates in order to increase the uptake of renewables in China and improve our energy efficiency. Closer to home, here in Europe, environmental investment partners are working to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by helping provide seed capital to wind and biomass generators. I know that the agenda today will enable all of us to learn more about these and other REEEP programs and the progress that is being made. Everyone here today has the practical experience and commitment to fulfill the ambitions set out in Johannesburg. Through our combined will, political, commercial, and human, we can develop and enlarge the market for proven energy technologies, which will further our shared development goals and tackle the environmental threats we face. It is noble and necessary work that I am proud of that the UK government is so closely associated with and committed to in partnership with you all. Thank you for everything you are doing, and let us look forward in partnership to even more progress and success in the future.
第36单元, 持续发展.
Unit 36, Sustainable Development.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Thank you for the invitation to be part of your conference. It is good to be at a conference dedicated to sustainability. I am a member of the Greenpeace organization, and sustainability is one of the four core Greenpeace organization principles. The government defines sustainability as enabling this generation to meet their needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet theirs. The other three principles are nonviolence, appropriate decision-making, and the need for social justice or fairness in our affairs. However, the principle most people will associate with the Greens is the sustainability principle, and most people will identify sustainability with the need to protect the environment. So today, I am mainly talking sustainability and its implications for tourism, not just about what a sustainable tourism might look like, but how the tourist industry might contribute to a sustainable future. First, what are the components of a sustainable future? Once again, it must be fun and much less wasteful of energy, time, and resources. It must be fair, so it will be a future that respects the right of all people to participate. It must recognize that our survival is dependent on preserving the biodiversity and the capacity of the planet to sustain life. We must live in ways that not only enhance the quality of our own lives, but the lives of the other species, communities, and generations with which we share the planet. It is also likely to be more local and less global as we attempt to source more of our needs from closer to home. When I entered Teachers College many years ago, I was told that an important part of my career would be preparing my pupils for an age of leisure. It hasn't happened. We are working longer and harder. While leisure is likely to account for substantially more of our expenditure and resources in the 21st century, it is likely to account for an ever smaller portion of our time. For generations, New Zealanders have gone off at Christmas and visited valleys or gone camping at the river or the beach, in tent and caravan. Today, we are likely to disappear to the other end of the country or to some other country for the weekend. We fly to Sydney for the day to watch a rugby match or celebrate a friend's 50th birthday. And we stay in hotel and motel and eat in restaurant and cafe. Holidays are a major component of our indebtedness. Many of the components of the tourist industry are or could be sustainable. Tourists spend much of their money on food and accommodation. Both are labor and capital intensive and relatively modest in their demand on resources and energy. Much of the food is likely to be, and could be even more, locally sourced. Locally produced food and crafts do not require huge energy inputs to deliver from other parts of the world, and most of the money spent on those goods and services is likely to remain in the communities where they are purchased. A relatively few visitors can make otherwise marginal operations viable. Restaurants, retailers, and arts and recreational activities and facilities that smaller communities might find difficult to sustain or justify on their own are likely to be successful when the visitors are factored in. Local businesses are likely to be more willing to sponsor the community element in cultural and community activities in recognition of the custom these activities are likely to bring to their businesses. Tourism can strengthen local culture. Culture is more than the arts. Culture is all of the qualities that make each of our communities unique. The concept of cultural tourism needs to identify what it is that makes all elements of the New Zealand visit special. The New Zealand unique culture could add a great deal more to a uniquely New Zealand experience. It is just possible that the recognition by our tourists of what it is that makes us uniquely us may be instrumental in developing a pride and confidence in all elements of our culture, including the language, the history, and the values. Most New Zealanders enjoy welcoming visitors into their communities. We are a pretty parochial lot and enjoy being able to show our places off, and I suspect that while numbers may put the pressure on our most beautiful lanes, it is the visitors and the possibility that we might lose them and the need to be liked that will see us look after our heritage and conservation estate. We can probably continue to feed and accommodate current numbers, and probably more if we distribute them more carefully. However, parts of New Zealand are already over capacity, and I have a concern about the sustainability of all of our activities, including tourism, and about the lack of any analysis of the impacts of fuel shortages on tourism or any other aspect of our lives. I have no doubt that international travel will continue, but is there a point at which air travel becomes prohibitively expensive for all but the prodigiously rich? And do we have a handle on when that might be? And might the outcome be fewer guests for longer stays? If air travel does become the preserve of the very rich, what kind of experiences will survive? Energy is likely to be a limiting factor, but I would prefer to examine how we might like the future to be. That's all for my presentation today. Thank you.